Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission will now come to order. Today is Friday, August 26, 2016. We're meeting in the Minnesota Senate Building, Room 1200. I'd like to welcome commission members and the public that's with us today. Thank you for joining us, and as we continue our work, I'd like to turn your attention to our agenda as we begin. And the first item of business would be introductions. I'll start, and then I'll turn to my left, our House members. My name is Greg Clausen. I serve the communities of Apple Valley, Rosemont, Northeast Lakeville, Coates in Dakota County. And that is District 57, Senate District 57. And if we could start on the end. Yeah, thanks. Yes, you would.
Okay. Getting to know the lay of the land, I'm Representative Lori Halverson, and I get to represent the eastern half of Eagan.
And I'm Jen Schultz. I represent East Duluth.
Representative Tony Albright, I represent the middle third of Scott County.
Representative Tara Mack, and I represent part of Apple Valley and part of Lakeville.
Senator Tony Lorie, I represent Senate District 11, which is all of Carlton and Pine Counties and most of Kennebec County.
I'm Senator Mary Kiffmeyer, and I represent Senate District 30, which includes Big Lake, Elk River, Otsego, St. Michael, Albertville, Hanover, and 14 wonderful homes in Dayton.
Well, thank you, commission members. And again, welcome people that we have in our audience and are with us today. I'd like to turn your attention to a document that has been distributed, Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission. It's our draft of a work plan for 2016. You'll see that we have six meetings that are scheduled. And also you'll note that our charge statements are listed there on the left side of the document, and then we filled in some portions with upcoming agenda items. And again, this is a working draft, so we'll be talking about this as our meeting goes on today, and we will probably be making some additions and perhaps some subtractions as well. But I would like to announce our upcoming meeting two will be held on October 4th, starting at 10 o'clock in the morning, and will be chaired by Representative Mack, and the location is to be determined, so we will get that information out. I'd also like to turn your attention that we do have a website. If you look at the bottom of our agenda, you'll see that you can find background information posted on our website, upcoming meetings, minutes from previous meetings that we've held. There's lots of information there if you'd like to get some additional background information on our charge statement and the work that we've done in the last 2 years. With that, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Schoenbaum from the Minnesota Department of Health. He'll be reviewing the commission charge, overview of last year's report, 2016 legislative session actions of the commission, and recommendations. Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Good morning, members. Good to see everybody again. Kind of one note about kind of the health department role in this commission. The legislation that created the commission assigned the health department to provide technical assistance to the commission. We were very pleased to get that assignment and that recognition, and so we have been doing our best to follow your wishes and help you keep things moving along. I'm going to be directing you to a number of handouts in your packet. The first one, which kind of we all already saw a version of on the draft work plan, is a single page that has the commission charge and membership. If we were to look at, this is an excerpt from the legislation establishing the commission. If we were to look at that longer language, we would see that the commission was charged to produce a preliminary report at the end of 2014 and is now charged to produce a final report at the end of this year, and then the commission sunsets. Continuing in your package, I think kind of you all know what an important issue this is, and I just thought I'd include a couple of kind of just recent highlights of that. You will find an excerpt from a newspaper article from last week. Minnesota adds 11,300 jobs as healthcare industry leads the way. Kind of half of the new jobs in that period were in healthcare. And a more detailed handout from recently produced in April by the Department of Employment and Economic Development just focused on the Twin Cities, but provides additional details on kind of the size and strength of the healthcare sector and provides details by both employer and type of job. So those are just kind of reference materials I thought you might find kind of helpful kind of as we kind of jump back into this topic. You should also have, and I'll try and make this kind of brief, you should also have in your packet a copy of last December's report. And don't worry, I'm not going to go through the whole thing. But if you would turn to pages 25 and 26, let me first direct your attention to page 26. There was kind of a lot of material generated last year, robust discussion, kind of good work, kind of organizing, sifting, setting priorities. And on these pages, I think you find two important sections of the report. You find a set of goals and principles on page 26. And maybe I'll just pause for a moment and kind of people can skim those. And then on page 25, you will find the priorities that resulted from a ranking exercise that you completed towards the end of your meetings last year. Number one focuses on the challenges of having enough preceptors. Number two focuses on scope of practice. Number three focuses on the MERC program. Number four focuses on nursing and nursing education. Number five focuses on telehealth. And number six focuses on the mental health workforce. Any questions or reactions to any of that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually would like, perhaps, if it's available, a little bit more explanation about the occupation with the highest relative demand per county in the metro area. It's on the focus on healthcare worksheet. What's jumping out to me, and I guess I would like a little more, perhaps, explanation, is that the first year of our work, there was a lot of focus on essentially top of licensing work, making sure that we're supporting advanced practice nurses, physicians, et cetera. But when I look at this list, particularly when you look at Dakota County, Anoka County, it's the highest demand in the workforce is actually for licensed practical nurses and healthcare support work. And so I'm wondering that those two stood out to me. I'm wondering if there's some more explanation about why that level of healthcare professional is in such high demand in certain areas. It looks like, and then you look again at psychiatric technicians and respiratory therapists and in other counties. But the fact that essentially support workers are really in high demand in certain counties, why that might be and why what we might be missing with in relation to our goals. If anybody has a comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Halverson, I can give you kind of a general kind of framework, but I think if we want somebody to dive into this table, we should probably have the Department of Employment and Economic Development but come and explain it to us. But something that we documented in our 2014 report is that the shape of the healthcare workforce can be conceived of as a pyramid, and kind of the most highly educated professionals are the very small top of that pyramid, and most of the healthcare workforce numerically are people at the bachelor's level and below. So that's, I think, the general landscape that I don't think is surprising to see reflected on this table, but we'd have to get the folks that did the table to tell us more.
Representative Halverson?
Mr. Chair, as a follow-up, I think that pyramid discussion is really important, and I think as we move forward, I guess I'd like to maybe make sure that we're thinking about how, making sure that we're being equitable, I guess, in the way that we look to driving the workforce throughout the pyramid, because it does seem to me that we have a lot of top-of-the-pyramid goals, and I want to be sure that we're not missing goals further down. So that explanation is helpful. Thank you.
Just one additional comment. I know that one of the goals that we wanted to look at is removing barriers. And we had quite a bit of discussion and testimony, I think back as early as 2014, about clinical hours that our nursing staff needs and other professionals. And that was somewhat of a bottleneck. And that's been one of our goals, to look at how we can expand clinical training facilities and options for our workforce. I remember we had one young lady that spoke that she had an 8-month wait in order. She had finished all of her studies but was waiting for her clinical hours and was having difficulty achieving that. And so that was a bottleneck that perhaps we've been trying to work on, expanding those clinical hours to get more people into that workforce flow. So that your comments led me to be thinking about that, and that's, again, one of the goals that we have established. And I know that that Mr. Schoenbaum will be speaking to that here shortly in some of the 2015 bill, some of the 2015 bills that we actually had moved in the legislature unsuccessfully, however. So. And Senator Loring.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, to your point about some of the nurses not being able to get some of their clinical training, I only read the executive summary, so I might be getting this a little bit off, but last week we got notice from the Board of Nursing that they're changing some of their rules around access to the profession and getting away. There is some new evidence on the scene from the national level that shows that some of the, coursework is able to replace some of that clinical that we've required in the past. And so there are other groups working on some of these access issues to the profession, maybe as a task force. I only read the executive summary. That's what I got from it, was that there are other training exercises that have proven to be as effective as some portion of the clinical. It's not a complete replacement of the clinical, and that the Board of Nursing is pursuing and has out for public comment right now some changes to the rules to actually streamline that a little bit. So there are some other groups working on some of these same issues. So it might be of interest for this task force to learn. And I could use some help reading everything that comes through, too. So,
I know we do have members of the Board of Nursing in the audience. And if they would care to comment on Senator Lurie's comments at this time, it might be appropriate. And while you're thinking about doing that, though, Senator Kiffmeyer has some comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think on that point, because I also serve on the Capital Investment Committee, we have toured those kinds of sites in a variety of situations. And they are, being a nurse myself, looking at how those are done. And because it's in a safe situation where you have a patient model, you can experience traumas and work with students and evaluate. They videotape. They store everything in memory, so they're able to go back and make it a learning experience in a way that in an actual clinical, you would be in a much different situation. Of course, those will eventually come, but I think they are very valuable, and there are several models now in a variety of the professions that they're doing that. St. Cloud Technical has one bay that they do that. There are a variety of others as well, and I think that is being very helpful, not a substitute for, but often taking the early learning before they get to actual patient clinical. I think the adjunct, those two together, I think it can be very, very helpful. But because of capital investment, we've toured them, had a chance to see them. Mr. Chair, I also wanted to comment, though, that I noticed on our page 26 also where we were focused on that is a certified nursing assistant. And again, that requirement that has gone away of that being part of the nursing school has really reduced also and contributed to the shortage. But my one question, and maybe Mr. Schoenbaum, if the nursing board is coming up, please do. I'm perfectly happy to do that, but I did have a question for Mr. Schoenbaum on just process.
Mr. Chair?
Well, perhaps we can ask the Board of Nursing to comment, but I've also had a chance to look at those virtual reality situations, and they are very impressive. If you could identify yourself.
I'm Marilyn Krasowski, and I'm the Director for Education at the Minnesota Board of Nursing. Had been in MNSCU education for many, many years. The latest comment period is on the rulemaking, and thank you, Senator Lurie, that high-fidelity simulation could replace up to 50% of the clinical experience, up to. And it's very important, as Senator Kiffmeyer mentioned, it is done. It is related to some very well evidence-based studies that have been completed through the NCSBN. And so it is on evidence that they have found that there was not a difference with those who had substituted clinical simulation for actual real simulation in terms of the outcomes and their performance. It is a critical shortage of clinical sites right now that all of the nursing programs are facing, particularly in the specialty areas like OB and PEDS. With this rule, then, a program could substitute even those specialty experiences with high-fidelity simulation. And again, it's high-fidelity. It's not like just the old Annie that we had, but it is looking at virtual reality. It's high fidelity mannequins that really allow someone equivalent experiences. So oftentimes you hear students saying, "Well, they got to do this and I did not." So it equalizes the kinds of experiences that they have, and so they are all assured of having those. So it's quite groundbreaking and based on some very significant evidence-based studies.
Any questions for our testifier?
Yes, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I realize that when you commented there, many times in an actual clinical, if you're on, say, a pediatric rotation or a B rotation, the patients just come and the situations come as they are. And so any individual may have certain experiences and mm-hmm. others won't, because you're just dependent upon the patients who may have a complication.
Right.
And so with the 50% being able to do that, you can put every single professional through those kinds of simulated if they don't get them in an actual hands-on type of real-life clinical. And that's really valuable to future training as well. And I didn't think to mention it, and I appreciate your clarifying that and saying so. Thank you.
Any other questions? I would ask... We have had legislation to expand clinical sites for the last two legislative sessions. Mm-hmm. Do you have a timeline that you're working off of as far as decision-making?
Yes, if the comment period ends successfully, which it will end September 22nd, and then we're at the point where then it will go to the governor's office and to the ALJ. And so we're hoping that it will be finalized for the December board meeting. So October board meeting, we hope to have at least an answer from the governor's office. And then for final would be in December. And then it would take effect at that 5 days after that, I believe. So it's been a long journey, if you will. And so we hopefully are at the end of it. It's received very, very positive support. So hopefully this year yet.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate your comments. That's very helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, one question for our testifier.
Senator Kiffmeyer has a question, please.
So how many current sites, thank you, Mr. Chairman, how many current sites do you have that are able to do this for any level professional, and how many do you anticipate bringing online?
How many?
After the rules are finalized. Are there going to be more locations doing this virtual?
There are programs who are ready to go now, and it's that the rule is not in place that they can actually replace clinical with clinical simulation. Almost all of the nursing programs are using it in some capacity, some not necessarily of the high fidelity. But there are virtual reality opportunities that are not the cost of the high fidelity mannequins. So there's different strategies there that they can utilize, but just about every program is pretty much ready to implement at least a portion of it. Also, we are working with Health Force, and we'll be sponsoring a conference in the spring. At least this is our latest plans, but Health Force is one of the centers of excellence, as you well know. And so we're working as a board in collaboration with them, and they have done outstanding work in simulation. So it's really kind of come at a crossroads where we're all kind of meeting now and expanding on best practice.
It'd be good, Mr. Chairman, if we could have kind of a update on an annual basis or something that gives us a baseline measurement that we can kind of quantify going forward as to, you know, what is happening out there and so on would be, if you could think of doing that.
Yeah, and it is interesting because, of course, it's not final yet, but have some really renowned people that are serving on this, what they call the MNCHEP Advisory Committee, which is a simulation advisory committee through Health Force. And one, in fact, is hired by NLN, who has done outstanding work on different scenarios and simulation work. So using with some really high expert people at this time. So we will be following it.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Lurie.
You know, this has been quite the tangent. Sorry, I hope it's helpful. But I do think it's important to look at, you know, other efforts to try to address some of these bottlenecks that we've identified. And I'm wondering if these sort of new training opportunities to get the workforce out there, if they're weighted toward any particular licensure level of nursing. You know, I mean, we have acronyms coming out our ears of different levels of nursing, and I don't know if this applies across the entirety of the nursing profession, or is it 50%? It can replace up to 50%
up
of
to 50%
clinical
for practical and professional level. So okay. That would be the LPN, the RN, associate degree, and the baccalaureate.
Okay. And it's fairly evenly distributed across. I mean, it's not targeted toward a particular licensure level.
Not at all.
It's helpful across the board.
No. And in fact, there are a number of institutions that have, one, two, and three levels of nursing. And so they will have simulation labs that, really accommodate all levels of nursing. And it depends on really the acuity level of, mm-hmm. of the scenario.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll turn it back to Mr. Schoenbaum here to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'd ask you to take a look at a double-sided handout called 2015 and 2016 Session Update. This kind of tees up the next section of the agenda. This is just a summary of the health workforce provisions, largely but not exclusively appropriation-related that were enacted on page 1 in 2015 and page 2 on 2016. I've tried to be complete here, but I probably missed some things, so would welcome kind of additions and corrections from any source. And I think the co-chair's tentative plan, which we'll get to when we talk about the work plan, is that we will hear updates on some of these items this morning, and some of them will come back to you for updates in future meetings.
Good. Any questions, comments regarding the provisions that we have worked on and have been enacted, or any of those that you don't find on the document? Any comments? Very good. We'll continue. Our next item of business is looking at presentations on the implementation of 2015 health workforce investments that have been made, recommendations that the Commission has made. And we have a number of testifiers that will be with us today. We'll start with the Minnesota Department of Health. Mr. Wilson.
Good morning,
welcome
Mr.
to the
Chair
committee.
Members. Thank you. I'm Will Wilson from the MDH Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. I'm a supervisor of our grants unit. And the mic's not on?
Is it
can
on?
You hear me?
It's on.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members. My name is Yende Anderson, and I'm the coordinator of the International Medical Graduate Assistance Program.
Good morning, Commission members. Better? Okay. My name is Dr. Kathleen Brooks. I'm a family physician, and I'm the director of the Rural Physician Associate Program at the University of Minnesota Medical School. And I apologize in advance. I'm losing my voice. I'll do my best.
Well, welcome. And again, thank you for joining us today. And all of you have expertise in areas that we are interested in and getting updates on our work and we have a PowerPoint presentation that we're going to be looking at to begin. Mr. Wilson?
We do, and as soon as we can get that up, I'll get started.
Very good.
Members, I believe you have a handout as well, so I can probably get going a little bit on it.
It was up earlier.
It was up. I think maybe it's the projector that's on sleep mode.
In your packet, though, there is a handout with the slides.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yandy Anderson and I are going to give you an update on some of the initiatives that were passed in the 2015 session related to healthcare workforce. In particular, if you want to look on the second slide there, we're going to talk about the loan forgiveness expansion. We'll also talk about primary care residency grant, the International Medical Graduate Program, and also the new home and community-based services scholarship program. So, well, I think let's just keep going.
Very good.
To jump right in, I'm first going to talk about the loan forgiveness program, and that's on the third slide that you've got there. So in 2015, the legislature passed an increase in funding for this program of about $2.5 million, bringing it to just under $3.25 million. Which represented about a quarter or a quadrupling of the size of the program. It's a significant investment in loan forgiveness, and the legislation also expanded the number of professions that were eligible to receive loan forgiveness awards, and that included mental health professionals, dental therapists, and also advanced dental therapists, and public health nurses. In addition to that, I've neglected to mention this on the slide, but there was also language in the legislation that required the department to consider cultural competencies of applicants, and we have done that. We've made it a very important part of the application process, and we've also made it a part of the review process, so we are factoring that in. The initial results, other than just a lot more work for the program, the initial results are fairly positive. There is still high demand for the program. We receive way more applications than we can fund, even with the expanded dollars. And some areas of the state do have challenges recruiting. That's not something that this program is necessarily going to solve. In essence, this program, we give the awards to the individuals themselves, and then they find work that meets the requirements. So if it's a program that has a rural requirement, they look for a job that meets that requirement outside of the metropolitan area. And so places that are deep rural or very isolated are still going to have challenges attracting these people to come to their to work at their facilities. But you'll see this in a little bit. We have some slides showing where the people are actually working. The results have been pretty positive in that regard, too. The geographic distribution has been fairly broad. Lastly, demand for mental health professionals has way outseated our expectation. In the first year, we advertised the program, didn't receive too many applications, but in the second year, the word got out. And for mental health professionals, we were receiving, I think it was 80, 85 applications for something like maybe 30 positions. And they're all good applications. It was not an easy review process. So on the next slide, and I apologize that this is really small. I was hoping we could get this put up on the screen, but I'm going to take some time and explain this. The columns, first of all, are the professions that are eligible: physicians, pharmacists, dentists, nurse faculty, mid-level, which is nurse practitioners and physician assistants, and some other nurse categories. Public health nurses in a nursing home. And the new ones from 2015 the 2015 session that started are public health nurse, dental therapist, and advanced dental therapist, and rural mental health professions and urban mental health professionals. There were two separate categories for that that professional category. You can see there barely the numbers for the other columns. which are 2015. This was a normal cycle that we had, which was about somewhere between 14, 15, 16 people would receive awards for all of the professional categories. That was before the expansion of the new money. We ran another cycle the same way in 2016, which is called 2016A under this graphic here. And then the new money kicked in 2016, so we had a second cycle in 2016. And you can see, there we go. Now we're up. Wonderful. So 2016A was our normally scheduled cycle. 2016B was the new money that kicked in. And 2017 is the most recent one. So you can see there the numbers are growing, and particularly with the rural mental health professionals and the urban mental health professionals. Now the last three rows, I'll explain this a little bit. The new contracts are the ones, the new awardees for that cycle. As you can see, that number is growing significantly. The number of applications, I just wanted to show you the full number of applications that we received. And you can see that the demand is there. I think we've done a good job of advertising the program with some exceptions. I think we have some work to do with pharmacists, dentists, and nurse faculty. We have a little bit of work to do to get the word out, but we will do that. And then that last row on the bottom of the chart here is called field strength, which means that's the total number of people who were under contract for this program during that fiscal year. So in 2015, we had 59 people total in the program. That's the 2015 year plus the previous years, because this is at least a three-year program. They sign a contract for at least 3 years, and they have an optional fourth year. So that includes everybody who's in the program during that fiscal year. We have now gone up to 207. Our expectation is that when this is fully operational after a couple of years, we've had a couple more cycles of full funding, we'll have somewhere around 280 to 300 people in the program throughout the state, which is actually more than I think we had anticipated. So relatively positive. Let me show you where people are. This is a graphic that we just put together. This is 2015, the numbers that you've already seen. If you look up at by Brainerd, there's a 2 there. That's two people from the same location. Here is 2015 and 2016A, relatively normal. Here's where the new dollars start to kick in. And here's where we are now. So as you can see, geographic distribution is fairly good throughout the state. There are areas of the state where this program has not yet reached its full potential. And again, we have some challenges with that because, like I said, it's up to the recipients to find work. I do want to share one story, one data point from this chart. We had in 2016, the first cycle with the new dollars that kicked in. We had an application from a psychologist who works in the East Metro. And she gave a great application. She serves primarily the Hmong population there very adamant that she wants to continue to serve this population, especially people who have difficulty in getting either insurance or finding access. And the review committee said, okay, do what you can to make sure that this person, even though she wasn't eligible because she didn't meet the requirements for an urban mental health professional. But they said, do what you can. And so we called her, worked with her, and she said, okay, well, what's an area of St. Paul that would work and would let me meet the requirements to enter this program for the urban mental health program? And we showed her the maps of where they are. Primarily, it's University Avenue. There's some other in East St. Paul. And she said, okay, I'm going to move a clinic, or I'm going to open up a new clinic. And so now, as a result of this program, we have a new psychologist who is opened up shop on University Avenue in St. Paul. And, you know, it wouldn't have happened without this program. That's just one story. We worked with her quite a bit to make sure that that could happen. But in general, I think we've got a handle on how to administer this program so that we can maximize the benefits. Okay. Next up, I'm going to talk about a program that that also passed in 2015 that was called the Primary Care Residency Expansion Grant. $1.5 million.
Mr. Wilson, before we go on, any questions specific to that first program we've just heard? Yes, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I'm looking at the graph, and you mentioned about you've got some work to do in terms of I frankly am a bit surprised, happily, that the dispersion is what it is. But you see no concentration or no dispersion, kind of that Mason-Dixon line, if you will, north of the Grand Rapids area. And it seems like southeastern Minnesota is fairly lacking in terms of, is that conditional based upon the demographic not being as concentrated in an area that would require primary care or mental health service provider? Or are there other issues that have to be dealt with? And I guess the point that I'm going at is, how do you intend to convey the program to those areas in a more concerted effort than you would to, say, the seven-county metro area, where it seems like we've got a propensity for applicants?
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, thank you. There are a lot of factors that go into where people end up in this program. I think my comments about some of the work that we have up front is we want to make this program more attractive to the dental students and pharmacy students that are graduating, because that's really who the program is geared towards. We want to catch them right as they're coming out of school and moving to their first practice site. Chances are they'll stay there and, you know, start a family and then settle in that community. And so we have some work to make it more attractive to those students. As far as where the recipients ultimately end up and where they work, I would say first of all, we only get the applications that we receive from when we put out the RFP. Have more applications than we can fund, and we do factor in geographic distribution. To your comment about things north and in the southeast corner, what we see is the applications that we've received, I would say about probably 60% to 75%, depending on the profession, they already know where they want to work. They've already got a location picked. They've got they might even have a letter of reference from their future boss or their future facility. Of the ones that don't know yet where they're going to be working, I think we can get them some resources about where there may be open jobs, and we do that. We have some other resources. There's a website called 3RNet that we can get them access to and help them with that decision of where they eventually want to end up. And I think it is incumbent on us to make sure that they're aware that there is a need in a lot of these other communities. But ultimately, it's their decision. And as long as they meet the requirements, then they're eligible for the program and eligible to receive funds.
Just a follow-up to that, any consideration on the geographic disparities of looking at eligibility requirements? In other words, to be eligible for the program, you need to settle in a certain geographic area. And then also, second point, you talked about making it more attractive. Are you speaking of incentives? And perhaps you could elaborate on that.
To your first question, it was, the geographic requirements are laid out in the statute. And it's basically any community outside of the seven-county metropolitan area, and then excluding the metropolitan statistical areas, Duluth, St. Cloud, Rochester, Mankato, I think, are in there. So as long as they meet that requirement, then they are eligible to receive funds. That's where they will eventually end up. And to your question about making it more attractive, what we do is we will go out to the dental school, we've done this in the past, or the pharmacy school in the metropolitan area, and do they have like lunches where you know, people come in and talk about programs that they might be eligible for. And so we give a presentation to say, as a graduating dentist, you might want to consider this program. And for dentists, it's not a geographic requirement. They can work anywhere in the state, but according to the statute, they have to serve at least 25% of their patient encounters. They have to be public program recipients, so Medicaid, medical assistance, or Minnesota Care. And so for some dentists, that's not particularly attractive. But for the ones that it is attractive, we try to, you know, get them as much information as we can. If we need to connect them to clinics that we know serve that population, we can do that. So I think it's a and there is only one dental school in the state. And generally we get about maybe 8 to 10 applications. The last couple of years we've gotten fewer. So it's been somewhere in the 6 to 7 range. So yes, we have some work to try to make this a more attractive concept for somebody who's just graduating and wants to pay off some of their debt. We have increased, based on the formula, we have increased the award amount for dentists. It's now $30,000 a year for up to 4 years, so that might help. And that's based upon the average debt load that these professions have. So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. So if we're to – this might be an area of our commission to look at further legislative action perhaps to incentivize as well. So I appreciate your comments. Yes, Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as a follow-up to that discussion, my question is, you mentioned the dentist, but I know we added the category of dental therapists as well. Are you seeing the dental therapist reimbursement being more highly utilized and utilized more in Greater Minnesota, or how does that play into our need to cover dental care throughout the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, the way the program is set up is for dental therapists and advanced dental therapists to be in this program, they have to work in a rural area, and it's the same definition as for all the other professions. And I believe they receive, I have my handy cheat sheet here, so dental therapists will receive $10,000 a year, and again, that's based on the average debt load for that profession. $10,000 a year for up to 4 years, and the demand for that program was I think higher than we expected it initially. There aren't that many dental therapy graduates right now, but we got quite a few. I believe we got maybe 12 or 13 applications, and all of them were relatively good. It was something that that was a difficult review committee. So the demand is there, and I think as the program grows and year on year as we keep adding more people into the program, I think we'll start to see a bigger impact for all of these professions, especially the new ones.
Yes, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Mr. Wilson, I think one of the things that I hear you talk about, and I think for us, is that our goal here on this is to meet a need, and the need has to be evaluated on an annual basis, because as the program is implemented, an area might be satisfied and a new area come up and have a need. There may be a shortage here, or, I mean, there's that flex. So I'm also concerned, though, that you have enough flexibility that we don't tie hands too much with legislation or regulation or, you know, criteria that we end up funding a need that is no longer there, missing a need that is there, and some of those things. So do you feel that as the program is currently structured that you have enough flexibility to adapt to ongoing changes in both needs and also the supply?
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, yes. A few years ago, the definition of rural was shrunk considerably. It included, for example, I think Hibbing was not included in that, or Wilmer, and it was shrunk down considerably. But that was changed with this legislation as well. And so the definition of rural, I think, is broad enough so that the program and the reviewers who ultimately make the decision on this have the ability to look at, you know, areas of need and factor that into their decision-making. The other pieces of the program, there are moving pieces, you know, maybe not every year, but for example, the award amount is based on the average debt load of the profession, and that can change year on year, and it does occasionally. So that adjusts to meet the need. And then also, I think in general, you know, I think we're the work that we have to do is to continue to market the program, to get it out there and make sure that we have enough applicants. And at the moment, we do in just about all of the categories.
Mr. Chairman, just a thought.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think one of the concerns I also have is that when I hear you talk about 3 years and 4 years, one of the things that I think is really important is if you've been in a community for 3-4 years, you become bonding, attached, you become stable, you become involved in the community, and you're more likely to stay on after. That's a really important component of this. We want to help make sure that we not only incentivize them and help and further this, but we want to keep them there on a longer-term basis. One of the things we talked about was stretching things out into the 4 or 5 years to kind of enable that. Backloading, in other words, maybe 10,000 the first year, and the last 2 years, 20. You know, so they have an incentive to hang around for that, and then also maybe those other factors of bonding with the community that they stay longer. Could you just comment on that, on some of the things that I've mentioned here? Do you utilize them? Do you focus on that? Just comment.
Yeah, Mr. Wall. Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, yes. There was a study that came out in about 2002 or 2003 that looked at the different incentive types for attracting professions to work in a shortage area, scholarships or, you know, stipends or loan forgiveness. And actually loan forgiveness had the best long-term retention outcomes of any of those options. And we are measuring for the physician program, we're also measuring retention for 5 years after the people are out of the program. And I believe the last time we looked at it, it was about 80%. For just the physician program, so I think it's a program that is probably the best way to do this, to attract and to retain individual people within individual communities that we know of, and I think we can see some of those results, and we are tracking that year on year.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a comment on Senator Kiffmeyer's first question. You know, if you look at the map up in the northwest quadrant there of our state, we don't see many people that are choosing to go there. And as long as the program is set up where they get to select, the applicants select where they are going to practice, we may always be experiencing what we're seeing currently. You have flexibility to move, but if they don't choose to go there, our hands are somewhat tied.
Mr. Chair, I agree, and I think where we see the applications that do already know that they want to go up there into the northwest corner or other parts of the states, I think the review committees are generally giving them a higher priority. Okay. So we have the ability to adjust some of that. But I think within the structures of the program itself, we are to some extent dependent on the applications we receive, It's a combination of what we can do to make it attractive and what providers out there can do to make their own facilities attractive as well. It's hard to make the connection between a provider recruiting somebody and saying, well, if you come here, we'll give you loan forgiveness because it's a competitive program. And I think it's hard for us to really make that link with the program, mm-hmm. but to the extent that we can, where we have applications that we receive, they do receive high priority.
Okay. Just a follow-up question. Are you seeing any of the private providers in the state initiating their own incentives where they are building on top of? So let's say in Crookston, Minnesota, the local hospital there might say, we will provide an additional financial incentive for you to practice in our area? Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, yes, we do. We know of some individual loan forgiveness programs that maybe a hospital or a nursing home. We'll talk about some home and community-based services scholarships in a bit. But yes, they do exist. I don't think we have a really good sense of how much is out there. I will say that we work with the Delta Dental Foundation has just started their own loan forgiveness program last year, and the timing worked where we could actually coordinate recipients, and we made sure that we weren't double dipping or somebody was in both programs. And their program, I think they saw, I believe they picked four dentists, and I think three of them were in the northern part of the state where we might have some gaps. So yes, we do coordinate with some of these other programs when we can.
Very good. Yep, Senator Kiffmeyer.
So what you're saying here, though, is that what you're reporting as far as is what this particular program does. So what we as a commission would be missing is what are others doing that may be having some results up in some of those target areas. The other question is, are you able to advertise, recruit, promote, like you mentioned, going into a particular graduating class school? You're able to do that, so maybe in the future, that can be a target area that you could recruit for. You have that flexibility, right?
Yes, we do.
Good,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Auburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the dots on that map, how many are returning home?
It's a good question. I would say maybe it depends on the profession, but I'd say maybe a quarter. You know, an example in Roseau, that was a really good example where the person went to school and they knew from day one they were going to be, you know, I'm going to go to Roseau. I'm going to medical school. I'm going to come back. I'm going to work in the hospital. I'm going to do this and start my family. And we do see that, but it's not the majority. We're attracting new people to communities.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Albright.
Thank you. To that point, not only I'm sure we would agree it's beneficial to attract new people, but the community support that would be beneficial to someone going and getting that degree and coming back, and in your attempt or your efforts to recruit new applicants from those areas that, you know, are a little bit sparse in terms of dots on the map right now, would that not be beneficial to reach out to the high schools and to the communities themselves to encourage application if they're going to be sending someone or have someone in the high school that aspires to go to med school, that it is a concerted effort on the part of the community to continue to have that continuity of care, whether it be a dentistry, the medical profession, or in you know, the mental health disciplines. Just encouraging you to broaden the scope in terms of who you might be marketing to for applicants.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's a great idea. We will do that. I think, yes.
Thank you. Please proceed. Sorry for those interruptions there, but good questions. Thank you.
So next up is a program called the Primary Care Residency Expansion Grant, fairly straightforward program. It's $1.5 million to fund new slots in what were deemed primary care residency programs. And you can see there the eligible types of program, family medicine, general, internal, et cetera. Psychiatry is also in this category of primary care, and those funds are prioritized. I think if it's available, then if we do receive applications from psychiatry programs, then those would receive a priority. The way the money is contracted out is up to $300,000 per additional resident for over 3 years. You can see the breakdown there of how that is distributed. There's also a little bit of money for a planning grant. If a residency program wants to plan how to expand, they can apply for that as well. And here are the results. So the programs that did get funded, there were two that were not funded. There was one planning grant that was applied for. It was partially funded by the review committee, but then they declined the funding. So these are the ones that did receive funding. Of the definition of expansion, there were two different interpretations of that, and I think the statute allowed either one of them. But United Family Medicine, which is in St. Paul, decided to expand their entire program by one resident for each year. So I've got down here that it will be three new residents during the grant period, but it's going to be a new resident ongoing after the grant dollars are done. The other grant programs, or the, excuse me, the other residency programs decided to add this number of residents to one class or one year that will follow through, and then they'll go back to their original number. So the overall impact here is that there are 10 new physicians that will be trained with these grant dollars and one program that will expand beyond the grant period into the future.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll reintroduce myself. My name is Yende Anderson, and I'm the coordinator of the International Medical Graduate Assistance Program, and I'm excited to share an update on the program today. What I'll do is I'll talk about the enabling legislation, share how that legislation was implemented, and provide some early impact information. So the legislation provided, and I should say that this is the first in the nation and so far the only in the nation program that is providing assistance to internationally trained immigrant physician immigrants throughout the process of integration. First, from even learning about the process to integrate into the healthcare system up to and including dedicated residency positions. So the legislation provided that the state work with a stakeholder group. And this was very helpful in creating this legislation and implementing it. And so there's also $500,000 provided for career guidance and support, clinical assessment, and clinical preparation, and $500,000 provided for dedicated residency positions in primary care. And if you note, these positions in primary care are a little different from the expansion grant. In this program, we don't support surgery, general surgery, but everything else is pretty much the same. There is an additional requirement to develop a roster of IMGs in the state and also to create a revolving fund to accept additional dollars to support this program. And finally, there's a requirement to study in consultation with the medical board and other stakeholders changes necessary in licensure to ensure full utilization of IMGs into the Minnesota healthcare system. Based on our work with our stakeholder group, this is how the program looks. So we offer career navigation and gateway support in collaboration with community-based nonprofits. They help with identifying IMGs to add to the roster. They also provide career navigation. They help with USMLE test preparation and help walk IMGs through the ECFMG certification process. And there's a lot of acronyms here, and I can answer them later. They also connect IMGs with skills in medical English and orientation to the U.S. healthcare system, and they provide training at the University of Minnesota also with electronic healthcare records. We then offer a clinical assessment, and this is also done through a contractor, and we are pending approval of a contract. It will be done at the University of Minnesota Simulation Center. And then we also provide clinical preparation. This is pending, but it will also be done through the University of Minnesota. And then we have residency application support, which is provided by community-based grantees and very few dedicated residency positions. For the early impact, the nonprofits providing career guidance and support are WISE and NAD Partnership, which is in St. Paul, as well as the Workforce Development Inc. in Rochester. And they are serving right now 114 participants. We also have the clinical assessment, which will be done at the U, and they're prepared to serve 15 IMGs per year. And this is very important in the program because it's going to inform clinical preparation of what is needed to help these doctors proceed along the pathway. The clinical preparation grant is in the final stages with the U of M. And also we have very limited dedicated residency positions. And I also want to point out that in this program, we actually fund the residency positions 100%. I think in the primary care expansion grant, it's not funded 100%, so the dollars go a little bit further. This year, the U of M residency pediatric residency program took a huge step in applying for our funding. They were the one and only program to apply. But they applied and they received 36 applications. And they initially only planned to hire one person, but based on the interviews and the qualifications of the doctors they received, they ranked four physicians. And only two physicians ranked that program. So as a result, they have one physician in residency that was funded through our program and one funded by the U of M. Another sort of takeaway from the implementation of the program is that because we are the only state providing this program, the word has gotten out across the United States. You know, integrating foreign-trained physicians is an issue that every state is facing. So because we're doing it, we get calls from all over the country. People are wanting to move to Minnesota to be able to participate in this program. And some of the people coming are highly qualified and have wonderful experience. So because we have stepped out there in front, I think we will benefit and get some highly skilled people in this state. The other sort of celebration we got to have is that because, again, we are innovative and you all supported this, we got an opportunity to go to Washington, D.C. and present this program to the White House Task Force on New Americans. And we were able to share the innovation that's happening in Minnesota and the goal, and they would like for us also to help with technical assistance so that this is also happening in other states. So I just want to thank you for your support of this program.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Questions? Commission? Thank you.
Good morning again.
I've got one more.
Oh, yes,
sorry.
Please.
Sorry. One more program to talk about, and that's the Home and Community-Based Services Scholarship Grant. So legislature passed this in 2015, made $950,000 available to reimburse employer-based scholarship programs. So the employers themselves establish their own scholarship programs for their employees, and then we can reimburse them for that activity. You see the eligible applicants there, the types of facilities, and then the types of scholarships and trainings that they can apply for. Briefly, some results here. We did receive a number of applications, about 87, which was good. We funded 31. Only 10 of them were fully funded, so the review committee really wanted to spread the money around. A good mix of degrees at versus training. Both of those are eligible categories, and we saw quite a good combination of people who were applying for scholarships for example, nursing, physical therapy, health support specialists, and then there were also trainings that were related to things like dementia care and English as a second language, things like that. I guess I have a list coming up. 15 of them were nonprofit, 16 for-profit. You can see the geographic distribution. And we also didn't just fund existing scholarship programs from organizations. We estimate that about 80% of them are new scholarship programs from employers that wouldn't have existed without these funds. Roughly 750 employees are going to receive funds. That's an average of about $1,200 each with the funding. And you can see the degrees that we got sort of a good spread there. The impact we're anticipating, just a better trained, more professional workforce. And we also hear from most of the applicant employers that once these employees do receive either their degree or their new training or their new certificate, they're going to get more money. They're going to get higher wages because they're higher trained. Last slide from me is just a the HCBS scholarship grant is open again right now. The cycle is open. Primary care residency grant will open in mid-September, and the loan forgiveness program in November. These are ongoing funding sources.
Good. Yes, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I really appreciate your report, Mr. Wilson. It's good to hear the work that we've done and to see some of the things coming through in those results. On this particular one, the home and community-based, this is many times entry-level positions, and this has got tremendous value. This is your, and also to professionally train and add value to folks who are already in and bring them in a step higher or so on. There's great value in that. When I kind of look at what you're saying here, do you feel that we could maybe increase the funding in this area, that the demand is there, that the need is there, that there's a capacity to handle that, that we could increase the funding and make better use of this program or add to it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, yes, we can always administer an expansion to the program, but yes, I think there is there's enough demand for this, and I mean, as you saw, we had 87 applications and funded 31. I don't know the dollar amount, but I think it was triple the amount that we could fund. That was the amount requested, and we received a lot of assistance from these home and community-based services organizations, care providers, and Leading Age, and they really helped to get the word out. And from what they heard as well, there's a lot of demand for this. So, yes, I think there's plenty of capacity or room for expansion.
And, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
I just wanted to comment, you know, for many of these folks who are at this level, that's a very entry level, their wages are anywhere from maybe $24,000 a year to $30,000. So when they step up, then they go up into the 36 or they may be even be lower. And for them to afford to get additional certifications or trainings is many times very difficult for them to afford, take the time off work. So this has particular value in that regard as well as to the patient. So I don't know where we come to some point along the way, but maybe we can just put a placeholder to consider this area for something more in the future.
Thank you. Could Mr. Wilson, could you go back to that early results slide? I think that the graph that you had. There was a graph, I believe.
For the loan forgiveness program?
Yes, that was a slide just before the one you had up there. I'm sorry, it's the high demand, 87 applicants.
Oh, I'm sorry, HCBS.
I'm going to turn my attention in this direction. With that first group, housing with?
Oh, I'm sorry. This is the distribution of the eligible facility types.
Okay.
And the ones that received funding. I apologize. I should have explained that. So for the organizations that were only housing with services, 13 received grants. The ones that were only home care, 9 did. Then there's a combination of home care and housing with services. They received 6, and there were 3 of them that were all 3 of the eligible categories of facility.
Thank you. And just to comment on Senator Kiffmeyer, that the home care is so important, you know, for so many of our elderly residents in Minnesota, and having them the ability to stay in their home rather than move to a nursing home or some type of a nursing facility. So I certainly would agree that, and this has been really an underserved area for training. And a lot of these people are making $12 an hour as starting out. And the additional funding that they can receive by additional education, I think, is a good investment. So thanks for going back to that slide. Appreciate that. Any other questions? All right.
Great.
Proceed. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, I will reintroduce myself. I'm Kathleen Brooks. I'm the director of the Rural Physician Associate Program called RPAP at the University of Minnesota Medical School and the newer MetroPAP program. Just some background. The RPAP program is 45 years old. It was established in 1971 as a result of legislative investment in rural education of medical students at our medical school. Its goal from its inception was to nurture interest of third-year medical students in a career, future career in rural medicine and primary care. We have had 1,500 students participate in the program over that number of years. We have over 1,000 practicing physicians that we track out of that 1,500. Approximately 45% practice in rural communities. About two-thirds practice in family medicine. Approximately three-quarters practice in primary care, which we define as family medicine, general internal medicine, and pediatrics. About last count, I think it was 784 of the 1,500 practice in Minnesota. It is rare these days to visit a rural community and not bump into an RPAPer, a former RPAPer, which is quite fun as the director. So students who participate in this program from the beginning received a stipend, and I honestly can't find what it originally was, but for a number of years, it has been in the neighborhood of $10,000 for participation. This was meant to help offset the additional costs. Often students have some living facility, living home in either the Twin Cities or Duluth, and they have to find apartments, and they have to come back and forth. So the $10,000 has been $6,000 through the University of Minnesota budget, coming through the legislative appropriations, and $4,000 that the communities themselves provide to the students. And that has been, as far as I understand, since the beginning of the program. I will make a comment because this has been such a successful program that I have the privilege of presenting it at a number of conferences for other institutions around the country and in Canada. That fact is of great interest. That is highly unusual for other medical institutions to have communities not only agreeing to take responsibility for clinical training for students for 9 months, but also providing part of the stipend for that. So MetroPAP began in 2010 as a small sister program of RPAP with the same curriculum, but instead of spending 9 months in rural communities, students spend those 9 months in urban areas of poverty. And there has been significant interest in our students who start our medical school in serving underserved populations. But this is meant to give them an opportunity to really explore and deepen their understanding of areas of poverty. And so it's a sister program, and it has been successful. I served as the co-chair of the Governor's Blue Ribbon Commission that was took place in 2014, and as you all know, the Blue Ribbon Commission made recommendations regarding investment of funds into the medical school for medical discovery teams, and included in the recommendation was for some funding for RPAP and MetroPAP. And so of the $15 million that was allocated for each of 2 years, $750,000 of that has been allocated to the RPAP and MetroPAP program. So I'm here to tell you, A, thank you very much, and B, what we've started to do with that money. Fairly immediately last fall when we received the money, we had 31 students who had just started RPAP, so we increased their stipend from $10,000 to $20,000, which starts to at least begin to address the fact that they carry a huge amount of debt load, and $10,000 really doesn't address the needs they have for participation in the program. The MetroPAP students had previously not received any stipending, so we gave them the $20,000, for which they were very appreciative. We also began investing in some infrastructure so that we could better recruit students and so we could make better connections in our rural communities. We hired an administrative director whose job involves developing stronger relationships with our healthcare systems in rural settings. This program, when developed in the early 1970s, was really built relationally. The physicians who organized it at the medical school reached out to their colleagues in rural communities, and it was doctor to doctor, will you take on a student? Doctor to doctor, will you take on a student? We still do that. It is still effective because we have all of these wonderful alums that we can go to and ask for their participation, but it's not always efficient. We are a highly integrated state with healthcare delivery, and so to really best utilize resources, it's important for us to be able to reach out to the systems in a more organized way. And so that's what we've begun to do. I think one tangible result of that early on is we run a little pipeline program called the Rural Observation Experience, where first-year medical students, as they enter medical school, can apply and spend some time in the summer right before they start medical school in rural settings. We've typically had 8 to 10 students in the years that I've been involved in this program. This year, we had 25 students that we were able to coordinate and send out into rural communities. In my experience, we start them in the rural observation experience. They come back between year 1 and 2, and they do what we call summer internship in medicine, which is an elective going back to the rural communities. And those are our students who then become really interested in doing RPAP and apply. So I come to thank you for your investment, and we'll do our best with these students.
Thank you, Dr. Brooks. Questions? Between the two programs, then, yes. How many total students are involved?
So this coming year, we'll have 39 students. So we had a nice bump from 31 to 39, and we'll have 4 MetroPAP students.
And the Rural Physician Assistance Program is primarily located at the University of Minnesota Duluth?
No, it actually is located both campuses. The offices are on the Twin Cities campus, but we also have faculty from both campuses. And we accept students from both campuses. We're kind of the flow in from the Duluth students, year 1, 2, and Twin Cities students who are interested.
Okay. Very good. Questions? Yes, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how many students from the Duluth program received funding this coming year or last year?
Oh, gosh. Let me answer that more typically, if I may, Representative. Typically, we have about half-half from each campus. And I honestly, by the time we sort them out, I honestly consider them one cohort. And so I can't break it down off the top, but it usually is somewhere around 15 to 20 from each campus.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do the students that start in the Duluth campus, are they more likely to go into rural practice, even if they're not part of this RPAP program?
Dr. Brooks.
Sorry. I had a little trouble hearing you. Let me see if I heard your question correctly. Are the students who start in Duluth more likely to go into rural practice than the students who start in the Twin Cities? Yes.
Okay. And are some of those students not receiving the RPAP funds?
Correct.
Okay.
If they don't participate in RPAP, they do not receive those funds.
Okay. Any other questions? Dr. Brooks, Ms. Anderson, Mr. Wilson, thank you so much for your testimony. Greatly appreciate it. It's especially important for us to get the feedback on the investments we've made and how is that really in reality coming about. So really appreciate your testimony. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Mr. Schoenbaum, we do have a written summary, Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. If you'd like to share that with us, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, the staff from the pipeline program at the Department of Labor and Industry could not be here today. They did send an update on their letterhead, which you will find in your packet. I think to oversimplify, this is an employer higher education partnership program, apprenticeship-like program that supports apprenticeships in 4 industries, including the healthcare industry. You have many details in the handout. If you turn to the bottom of page 3, you can see the bullet list of healthcare occupations that the program is working on. That's probably the extent of what I'm qualified to say about the program, but they did respond with this update, and they are willing and interested to be here in person at a future meeting if you would like.
Very good. Any comments, questions?
Okay.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, you know, in my relationship with Dolly and some of the programs, particularly as they would pertain to some of the technical colleges, I don't know that we sometimes appreciate the import that these institutions convey to the healthcare industry. And particularly for the jobs that are longstanding and well-paying and well-meaning and well-deserved of our attention. So I would concur that, you know, possibly we lay this over or to emphasize our strong desire to have them attend our next meeting. I think it's really important that, particularly with the need for in-home care and some of the technical teaching aspects that these institutions provide to that industry alone, I think it's important that we undertake a really concerted effort in listening to what they have to say.
Thank you, Representative Albright. I think that's a good suggestion. I think it would be good to have the three components, actually. It would be good to have labor and industry here. I think also the training institutions, and then also who are the partners that are out there they're working with. I know Prairie Care is one, and some others. So maybe we could get representatives from all three areas. Good. We'll do that. Thank you. Well, Mr. Schoenbaum, anything else that we need to discuss here under the 2015 healthcare investments that we've made?
I think we're done, Mr. Chair. Just note the footnote there that you will find kind of the other updates on the other enacted legislation kind of sprinkled throughout the work plan we're going to look at next. We included the home and community-based scholarship program, you know, a long-term care program, because we had the health department people here today, but Representative Schumacher could not be here today, so we've kind of pushed the rest of kind of the long-term care programs into the future on our work plan.
Very good. Very good. Okay. Well, let's move on then to item number four on our agenda, priority topics for 2016 meetings. You have a work plan in front of you. Perhaps we should turn our attention to that. And Mr. Schoenbaum, if you could make some comments, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm going to ask you to kind of get kind of a lot of paper in front of you as we do this. So one is that work plan table. I think the other one is the list of enacted programs that we looked at earlier. I think another is to kind of take us back to page 25 of last December's report. And finally, you'll see a one-page table called 2015 Bill Legislative Healthcare Workforce Commission, which reflects some of your 2014 priorities, which kind of got introduced but did not make it to the finish line. You'll remember from previous years that this schedule was kind of a work in progress. You know, each time for the first few meetings, we kind of looked at what was on it, juggled things around according to your interests. You all brought additional topics you were interested in kind of into the schedule. And so we're starting that again. What you have on the work plan itself is, again, kind of a first start at one way your kind of commission meetings could go this fall. I don't know how you'd like me to proceed through it, Mr. Chair, or if you'd like to proceed through it, or what's your preference here?
Well, maybe a starting point would be to look at that draft work plan and maybe just let's make a few comments by yourself, but then also we could have comments from our commission members here as we go meeting to meeting and maybe try to firm that up a little bit, if that would be preferable for people.
Sure, happy to do okay. that, Mr. Chair. So meeting one, you know, we've just got most of the way through kind of as it was planned and laid out here. Meeting two, again, I probably should go on to meeting three to kind of continue to look at the schedule and what you would like to discuss and have presented. I think a question for you, particularly as we head towards a final report. We did kind of a heavy lift on looking at kind of the workforce landscape in our first year. You may want to consider updating that for your final report, and we could start that next time, or actually we could start that within the next couple of meetings. Going down that meeting two column, something else that was in your last year's priorities was additional attention to mental health workforce issues, so we have plugged that in there. Meeting three, one of the outstanding issues in your commission bill last year was this kind of governance and coordination topic, so that is tentatively plugged in there. And at the bottom of that column is a scope of practice agenda item. You've heard, you've talked about that in previous years. You've also heard that there is a project, a scope of practice project sponsored by the Governor's Office, the National Council of State Legislatures, and the National Governors Association underway. That project has a big kind of stakeholder meeting next week. So it seemed to be make sense to kind of wait until that happens and then hear a report from that project and include any other scope of practice topics that are of interest to you.
I think that would be a good opportunity. Over the last 2 years, we've heard a lot of testifiers about scope of practice issues, and I think that would be a good time to get public comment that those groups can come back to us, especially after having the report from the National Conference on State Legislators, National Governors Association, having that forum taking place. So that's just for those in the audience that are maybe listening to this future, that would be a good opportunity for different groups to come forward if they'd like to state, again, publicly their interest in scope of practice issues. So.
Members, I actually see something very important missing from this work plan. Long-term care was going to be on today's agenda, and we took it off the agenda, but we didn't plug it in anyplace else. So we'll add that back. Sorry about that. Moving on to meeting four. Again, last year you had an initial discussion of the Merck program and expressed an interest to dive deeper into that program. So that shows up on meeting four. You also, in your report, called out telehealth, and there was there's been significant legislative action in that area, so that shows up in meeting four. In the last couple meetings, you see just kind of some placeholder slots to fill in additional topics or topics that, as we go ahead, go through, you'll want to revisit. We start to kind of head towards a final report in meeting five. A question I have for you is that in the last two reports, we've had a table on what is the big picture of state spending on health, workforce, education, and training from throughout all of the legislative finance divisions that appropriate in those areas. We can certainly update that. The last session was not a budget year, but so it might not be a heavy lift, but we can certainly update that if you're interested. And then in meeting six, and again, I think it kind of remains to be seen how many meetings everybody's schedule is going to permit. But for now, this includes six meetings. There's adopting the final report and, again, placeholders for items that you have still to identify. Again, there are a couple of members that are not here today. When they sent, when they notified of their schedule conflicts, we encourage them to be thinking about and submit agenda topics that they wanted to see in the work plan. I haven't heard from anybody yet, but those may arrive as well, and we can certainly follow up with people directly after this meeting.
Very good. Comments? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, one thing I would definitely like to see us add to what's here, and thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum, for this good outline and work plan to react to. But when we look in our next meeting on October 4th of the workforce supply and demand update, I think that's good timing, particularly with legislation that's been passed and with funding changes that we've made to our state budget with regard to long-term care. I think that that might be a good time to look at Charge 2 as well and look at the healthcare financing aspect of this. Not just an update on workforce spending, but seeing how the additional resources that have been put into long-term care, what impact that might be having, doing a similar analysis with home and community-based services as well, because that's something that I hear about a lot from constituents with regard to concerns about staffing. Again, thinking about that, I like that pyramid description and making sure that we're looking at all pieces of that pyramid, and I think next meeting would be a good time to look at how we are financing and what kind of results that financing is getting with regard to staffing.
Very good. Just taking a note there myself. Thank you for that suggestion. Mr. Schoenbaum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson and members, I was maybe being a little too, it depends on how deep we want to dive into supply and demand. If we want to do kind of the kind of really deep dive that we did in the first year, I don't know that I'm going to be ready for the next meeting. But I think the kind of the more on the ground discussion from employers and of the long-term care legislation that you've enacted, that I think we could certainly be ready for that, with maybe a little light touch on supply and demand.
Representative Halverson.
And Mr. Chair, I definitely would like to hear from employers. I think that would be very, I think the timing would be great, actually. So thank you, if we could be ready for that.
Mr. Schoenberg.
And Mr. Chair, the other kind of resource that kind of was originally going to be here today was the Department of Human Services, to get kind of their perspective on the responsibilities that were assigned to them and how they, what they know about the workforce effects of those as well.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm obviously, the fall gets to be a fairly a busy time, notwithstanding the fact that we're all standing for an election in November, and we have commitments to that and obviously others. And I'm just looking at the schedule, and I'm the sense of urgency with some of these matters and the compression of getting all of that done by the 31st with a final report due to the governor. I'm just looking at meeting four and meeting five, and with respect to Mr. Schoenbaum's time, I'm just wondering if we ought not to, as a commission, think about within our charges the priorities that we feel are most compelling. I'm looking at, and you remarked about the report that's going to be coming back from the NCSL. In addition to, workforce supply and demand, that's coming up on the 4th of October. And I'm just wondering if there's an opportunity to maybe compress those into one meeting and combine the contemporary nature of both of those, especially with the workforce development. That's our charge, is workforce development. And I start looking at some of these, and while I don't disagree entirely, I think they're on the periphery of getting as many people attracted and incented to the workforce and develop their career paths. And I'm just wondering if some of these in the outlying meetings could be persuaded to, if we have time category, as opposed to really focusing on the meat and potatoes of getting people attracted and on a career path that is meaningful and productive for them and their families. So I'll leave that at there just as an observation that we are under a time crunch and the urgency for getting everything done. We could do everything, but would it serve us well in the areas that you as chair and others might find have more merit as a higher priority?
Do you have any recommendations in that area, specifically things that maybe we can push off for another time?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at meeting four and meeting five, and I know there's placeholders there. I'm under just charge number one, meeting five, and I think it's just opening up the opportunity for additional outstanding topics. If meeting four is really converted over to take on the force of reviewing the initial draft, we will need to come back and really look at the final draft before we deliver it to the governor. And so, in keeping with the timeline, if we availed ourselves of that initial first draft during meeting four, I don't even know when meeting three will occur, given the fact that Mr. Schoenbaum and his staff will probably need a couple weeks to digest the contents of this meeting as well as the one on the 4th of October. In anticipation for putting a draft review together, it would, to me, look to add frustration to his calendar if we augmented and really just focused in on some really meaty topics that we can dive into a little more with consensus around, as opposed to pushing a broader range of topics forward. We have time to maybe take a step back and really take a look at a couple topics that we can really be more precise about and really get into the particulars about. And I know that I find that more advantageous, and I think the constituents that we serve would find that more advantageous than being, you know, more surfacey and getting a greater depth on some of those issues. And Mr. Schoenbaum probably can speak to that in terms of availing his time to focus on a couple of topics and strengthen our cause in those than a broader category.
Yep. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say that I think we could go to five meetings and see 3, 4, and 5 kind of pulled together a bit, just because with a legislative session next year starting on January 2nd, is it? 3rd, that it would be really good if we could kind of get our final report done earlier so we have more time to be ready for the session. But I think we can do that. Also, I'm willing to do a half-hour longer meeting if we need to, because once we're here and we're together, if we can do that, that might pick up the slack maybe a little bit. But I think the going a little more in depth. I do have one new subject, which I don't think we've ever covered before, and that is palliative medicine. And that may be a little information for next meeting. I did bring a little bit with me, but we don't have the time to do anything today with it. The other one is to make sure that on the physician's assistants, the mental health, we changed the scope of practice there. I'd really like to know how that's going. And I really appreciate Mr. Wilson's presentation and his comparisons of the years and the charts and the numbers. And Mr. Schoenbaum, if you could kind of let other folks know who are going to do some of these reports, that some of those ideas would be very welcomed by us as a commission, because one of the things that we do, and having been on for a while, is comparing the baseline. That was our first year. We worked a lot on getting a baseline and helping to make sure, and I noticed in the report that we're getting a better handle of that, but it's an ongoing work. But whenever we do have those reports, if we can keep that baseline and be able to measure, the one thing is it was new positions, and I think it was on the residency possibly, but I didn't have a baseline, so it was new on top of what? So it was 2 more, but what was it before? 10 or 50? It makes a difference. So I think having including those baselines and on those annual basis, it really helps us, because that's been our goal as a commission, is long-term target effect. It takes time to do that, but I want to also be able to, I think by having those, we'll have a better sense of are we accomplishing our ultimate goal, which was in the beginning. It's so easy to lose track if you only go from year to year. You don't get that. So you need kind of those charts or graphs so you see that. And I appreciated the map. That was really helpful. And also our partners, if there's loan forgiveness programs somewhere else, it'd be great if we could have, like it was verbally given, but it's helpful to know that, because what we don't want to be doing is doubling up and then missing target areas and enriching a certain area. So I think we need to get a kind of like that global thing, and I just thought there were several things that were in that one today in that PowerPoint presentation that I would love to see in other ones as well. I appreciate the paragraphs and the narratives, but there's nothing like a chart or a graph that enables you to really grab a quick picture where things are at.
Very good. Yes, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, the governor created a mental health task force that's been meeting around the state, and I'm wondering, is that going to be part of the update for our next meeting on mental health workforce issues?
I think we certainly could include that and ask for an update from that group.
Thank you.
I'm not sure how far along they are. Mr. Schoenbaum, do you have a comment on that?
I don't, other than I have the same question. This item got on your into your work plan from a mental health group focused on workforce from a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I should know if the current task force, how much the current task force is focusing on workforce. I don't, but I can find out and see where they are. And
I know they've had a couple meetings, and I know they meet in Duluth on September 12th. So I'm not familiar with what issues they're tackling immediately, but it would be nice to, if they are doing something about workforce.
We'll see if we can.
Thank you.
And going back, that I was part of that original group back in 2013 on the mental health issue. And even though that group's work was done, they are continuing to meet. So there are some things that they've been tasked to do, continuing their work. So I'm sure we can get an update from that group. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, can we get some tentative dates soon? Because I start teaching on Monday, and it would be great if I had it before Monday or soon after so I can block out those times from my course.
We will certainly work on that. Thanks. And I think Representative Albright alluded to, we're all busy at this time of the year, and it has been difficult to find dates that work for people, but that's well taken. We'll certainly work on that. Any other comments? Senator Kiffmeyer. Yes,
thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. I think one of the things that when we're doing this is that we are a very specific commission. It's about workforce. And to be focused on that, I think that fits in with another comment, you know, that to delve more deeply rather than try and do, we're not a Health and Human Services committee or a finance committee. We're a commission specifically to address the issues of workforce. And so I think for us to be effective on that, staying focused on those workforce issues, and there may be some interrelatedness, but my one concern is that we will be most effective, I think, as a commission if we also really stay focused on that mission that we're given.
Very good. Just as a quick summary then, I think what I'm hearing is let's look at five meetings rather than six, and let's try to pare down some of the discussion items that we have here, focusing again on our charge statements. We've gotten into some areas that certainly are related, but the co-chairs will meet, and Mr. Schoenbaum will get something back to you that shows a fifth meeting. We'll eliminate the sixth, and we'll look at paring down those topics as we've identified here and focusing on workforce, if that's agreeable, people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. Any other comments? Any other? We always have time for public comment. Anyone that would like to come forward at this time and make public testimony? We'd ask that you come forward and state your name and perhaps who you represent, if you'd like to do that at this time. Very good. I see we have three people potentially. And, you know, if you'd all like to come up and just have a chair, and that way we'll save some time. And if you, again, could state your name, perhaps who you represent, if that's the case, and we're happy to have you here. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me time to today to address you. My name is Jerry Matthew. I'm one of the participants of International Medical Graduate Assistance Program in Rochester, Minnesota. The IMG has faced many challenges in the United States in trying to gain access to workforce of our calling. We are thankful for you taking steps in addressing some of our challenges. I'm aware of other IMGs in Rochester area who are not able to access this program due to their J-1 visa status. It is my hope that you guys take yet another step to address this issue and allow more participants in this program. Many of us, while working on getting our license to practice medicine, work minimum wage jobs and sometimes jobs without a pay. The more assistance you can provide us will help us maintain a decent lifestyle while working on our licensures. With the passage of this law, I know I have hope in becoming an MD and practicing medicine in Minnesota. Your continuous support in funding this program will afford me and my colleagues the opportunity to finally achieve our dreams of practicing medicine and caring for population health. We all are in different levels of licensure process. You must work to see us to our success. Thank you so much for your efforts in ensuring my and others' success in achieving our dreams as medical doctors in the United States. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Any questions? Thank you so much.
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the commission. Thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, which is not the adoption agency located in Missouri. We do different things from them. Also, R&R Family Centers, which does crisis shelters, temporary and permanent housing and services, and APAC, which is a housing consortium. I just wanted to raise a few issues as long as you were talking about grants at clinical sites for non-physician training. I had the opportunity to attend a training that community members were even able to attend at the university. In this particular instance, they were doing trainings on CPR, which is different from the normal CPR that they used to train us on before. This is particularly important to me and my organization because we were founded on people that were affected by heart disease, and some of them have, you know, passed away already as a result. Had we had known the remedies that we could have taken as community members, as family members, I think lives could have been saved. And so one of our goals is that more people within the community, more families, more relatives, and even the patient themselves understand some of the different trainings that they could have as far as life-saving tools, resources, and access to people that do have the training knowledge that can help them when there's emergency and needs in the community, rather than just relying on 911, which I understand in the rural areas, it may take as long as half an hour to get a paramedic out there. And so I would encourage more support or further availability of training and free training and resources to this segment of the community. I also realized that some of the hospitals, clinics, and even the funders are looking at how can we be more cost-effective in health care. And this is what they're looking at, only their thoughts were, is more at a lower end as far as how can they interact with some of the services as far as data services provided between clinics and so forth and affect that system rather than the more immediate hands-on care. Another issue related to cost savings as far as clinical sites is that it's unfortunate that our clinical systems charge for things that they get, for example, free samples of medicine or Band-Aids and things like that that normally I have seen given out at expos in little first aid kits, and that if a person needs it immediately, they don't have it ready. But and I have seen patients ask clinics for some of these things like Band-Aids or aspirins and something simple they could get at a store, but they just don't have quick access to, but the need is immediately. And before the clinics can give it to them, they have to charge a clinic visit and then give them the supplies that they can virtually get for free. So I'm hoping that there's something that could be done in that area, and maybe they're looking at the liability issues. I don't know. But there's a lot of self-help care that these community patients and others can provide themselves if they had access to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee.
Hello, my name is Mimi Wu, and thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to speak here. I am a medical doctor from Burma, and I do want to thank everybody here on this commission, especially Mr. Schoenbaum and the Department of Rural Health for making this IMG grant possible and carrying it to the national level at the White House. It's, I mean, we do appreciate it very much. I am currently working for a nonprofit organization called New Americans Alliance for Development, which the grant, with the grant funding, we are working on it for the career guidance portion. And what I want to do, talk about is that it, even in our small, very small organization, we have over 30 doctors who are residency ready, who have passed the ECFMG certificates. It's called the Educational Commission for Foreign Medical Graduates. They've passed the exams. Senator Kiffmeyer mentioned the gap between the surplus and the shortage. There is a need in the rural area, and we have a surplus, is what I would like to mention. So we need to do more about gapping the two, surplus and shortage, and retaining them in the community. Our doctors, they are the citizens and permanent residents of the U.S., and they already live here in Minnesota, and they are willing to go to the rural areas. So this is what my comment would be. And this is a three-year program, and they still need to compete in the National Resident Match Program. So my thoughts would be to create a specific rural residency program like the physician assistants are doing. So if we can create a rural residency program that will be directed only to serve in the rural areas, and our IMGs, they don't require loan forgiveness, so there is not much, it won't be too much of the healthcare dollars going into it. There's already one model in Alabama. It's called the Cahaba Medical Care. They started with a for-profit clinic. It became a federally qualified healthcare center. It was developed by Dr. John Waits, and it is now a family residency program. So it is just a rural residency program, and they serve the rural areas. If we can adapt that model, and instead of the 3 years, we can still do it as a two-year residency program and not be in the match. Why I'm mentioning is that these international medical graduates, the citizens, they have already gone through a residency program where they were trained, and now they pass the U.S. exams here again, so they are qualified twice. And to give them the 2 years and serve in the rural area, I believe that that would be a model that we can look into. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that suggestion. I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. Any other public testimony? Any other comments from commission members? If not, we will adjourn until October 4th. Thank you.